Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Podcast is brought to you by GoToMeeting. And if you're not using a web conferencing tool or the service that you're using now is kind of clunky, use my first choice, GoToMeeting. Because GoToMeeting is probably the easiest to use. You can turn a call into an instant online meeting in just one click. And it's affordable. As many meetings as you want for just $49 per month. Very secure, and it substantially reduces meeting-related expenses. So you can try GoToMeeting absolutely for free for 30 days. But you must visit gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for your free 30-day trial. And hey, how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and it's episode 161 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So happy you can join me. It has been really a very interesting time, I must say, that we've seen over the last, we'll say 3 weeks, but in particular this week, boy, did you get the news that was flying in every single direction about Europe and the, you know, whether or not the euro was going to stay together, and who knows if we're going to see Germany pulling out and Trichet talking about buying, and the arguments that are happening not only in Greece but also in Spain with the austerity programs, and now with Portugal. There was an interesting story that talked about that there's a tax in Greece on people who own pools. Only 300 people pay, and there's like 15,000 pools in Athens. So lots of things that are going on, protests that are going on, concerns that are happening, and it's all happening right now. We're going to try to make some heads or tails of some of that, give you some information about what is going on, maybe some things to do, and also talk to you about oil. We're going to do this a little bit differently today. I thought what we would do is, actually, Kevin Hoffman, who works with me, kind of my right hand and my left hand at the same time, is going to kind of talk about some of the things that have gone on in the markets, in the economy, around the world this week. And then we are going to actually talk with, after that, we're going to have a talk with Tom McClellan. If you remember him from the McClellan Market Letter, he does the McClellan Oscillator, so Mason Index, does a lot of good work with, I don't know if I'd call it market timing, but we'll call it with timing signals. But what's interesting is we had this conversation on Thursday, so I want you to think about what happened after Thursday, midday when we talked. And usually we have these interviews at the end of the week, way at the end, after markets close, so we can kind of sum up things. This week we did it on Thursday, and actually I think it really worked out really well, because some of the things that he said, I'll leave that for you to decide on some of the predictions he made coming into the end of the week. But let's just talk about a few of the things that are happening, and then we're going to get to Kevin. But as you know, that there was a big sell-off in the market last week, that glitch that happened. Was it more of a kind of the perfect storm? Because the SEC is not finding anything right now, or was it the fat finger trade that started everything? We talked about this on DH Unplugged, and it looks like that, so far, it looks like almost, I don't want to say a comedy of errors, but a lot of things that aligned quite perfectly to create this problem. And one of the big things was the differential between the New York Stock Exchange, how they treat the slowdown of orders and the halting of positions, or possibly even the curbs, we'll call it circuit breakers, that are in effect different than the NASDAQ and various different markets that are also trading the same security. And when those things didn't work in harmony, lots of bad things happened. And we saw that, and we saw now the SEC trying to address that. We also saw that in a big way, probably coming into this week, probably had to happen before markets opened on Sunday evening, close to a trillion dollar overall bailout, backstop, whatever you want to call it. It is different. We're calling it ETARP, But it's very different than what we saw maybe from our standpoint when we looked at the $700 billion, not the TARP, but the stimulus package. This is more like a TARP. It's more of a backstop for banks, for the euro, for the eurozone, and to make sure that the area stays solvent. Well, unfortunately, we'll get to this, like, some of the details in a second, that didn't really have a great effect on the euro. Question's going to be, is really more of a quantitative easing, the printing of money that's going from the left pocket to the right pocket, and what's going to happen there? Is it going to cause a slowdown or a very big recovery in the eurozone? That is yet to be determined, but right now there's a lot of concern, a lot of very antsy investors that are out there right now. We think that's to a point in certain areas it does create a buying opportunity, but you got to be very careful and very patient because there are some great opportunities. We saw this market in Europe, generally speaking, pop up dramatically after the announcement on Monday and kind of hold some of that, but then start trailing off to the end of the week, and there was some big losses actually on Friday. But generally speaking, that there are some great opportunities within the U.S., I think, and some of the companies here that is still doing a great job, really developing some great niche marketing opportunities. And the retailers actually are starting to kind of catch our fancy again. But you got to be really careful. You got to hedge out the portfolio. That's what we've done. We have, I think we mentioned last week, somewhere about 40-ish%, 38 to 42% exposure to our trading portfolio right now. And that has helped us through the problems of the last 3 or 4 weeks, as a matter of fact. I mean, comparatively, we have actually done very, very well. And even surprisingly, in the market move on the upside on Monday, we actually participated in a good amount of that with the kind of structure we have with our portfolio. So we were very pleased with that. But yet at the same time, there is a lot of questions that are looming over the horizon right now that we'll kind of go through. A couple of things that we've looked at are companies like some of the inland oil and gas exploration companies, St. Mary's, which is SM, Concho Resources, which is CXO. If you think that there is no shot of getting any kind of significant legislation to expand the offshore drilling, or even if offshore drilling is going to be curtailed, well, why not look at the inshore drillers, the inland drillers, we call them. And St. Mary's, if you look at their balance sheet, if you look at their projections on their cash flow and look at their overall return on equity as well as their long-term overall managerial structure and the way they do things, fantastic. At the same time, if you look at the same thing with regard to Concho, now both of these have natural gas exposure and oil exposure, so they're going to see a lot of movement if in fact we consider that oil is going to be hit, as it did get hit dramatically last week due to the fact that the dollar came up in value. But more interesting than just oil was the commodity structure and the commodity, the commodities overall, where we saw gold and silver outperform dramatically, and that's a different thing than we've seen historically. What we've seen historically is that the dollar would go down and oil would go up, dollar would go down, gold will go up. Dollar went up, oil went down, dollar went up, gold went up, silver went up. So you have to look at this as a flight to safety, finally, taking hold. What I mean by that is that gold was not really being used as a flight to safety vehicle as we think it should be. It was being used as a vehicle that was really a dollar alternative in terms of just being offset by the dollar like any commodity would. I think that gold proper use is more of a temporary flight to safety. I'm sure the gold bugs out there and Peter Schiff will totally disagree with me. But and he was actually quoting it something, I think, going to 10,000. Gold will go to 10,000. I don't know if it's in our lifetime, but that's what he was quoting, I think, last week on CNBC. But nonetheless, there is a lot of confusion out there. I think the biggest thing we have to look at and really study as investors right now is the continuing saga in Europe. China being in a bear market is important from a market standpoint, but what does that really mean? They still have a GDP growth in the excess of 11%. They are slowing down, pulling back. But at the same time, you see Hong Kong, I think they came out with an 8.6% print versus an 8.7 this week. So it's still a nice growth rate, but you know what? It is starting to slow down just naturally compared to where the growth rate was. So that's something you have to keep in consideration right now when we're thinking about all this. But you know what? Right now, let's bring on Kevin Hoffman to talk a little bit about, you know, what's actually been happening, some of the numbers, some of the economics, some of the kind of things that you really need to know, kind of as a review of the week. And then we'll come back and we'll talk with Tom McClellan, wrap it up a little bit. I think he's going to find some great nuggets in our discussion with Tom McClellan as well. So anyway, Kevin, how are you? Nice to see you, buddy.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks again for having me on. It's been a while since I've been here, so it's good to have me back. Today is the week of May 10th through May 14th. We're discussing a few things in more detail that that Andrew went through. This is the week of my birthday, but this wasn't such a pleasant week for European markets. There were continued strikes in Greece and rioting, as well as continued pressure on the euro and the pound as well. There was several different surveys out that suspected that 20,000 hotel bookings were canceled in Greece, which is not good for their tourism industry, which is a large means for them as far as taxes go. Huge revenue for them. One way they've looked to solve some of their problems is to go to the satellites to see who has pools and who doesn't. The reason for this is because there's a pool tax or a luxury goods tax on all the pools in Greece. So by going to the satellites, they're looking down to see who has them and who doesn't, and implementing and enforcing those taxes on those particular people. Right now, it looks like only 300 people in just Athens have claimed their pool for taxation purposes. But according to the satellites, it looks like there's around 17,000. And you wonder why Greece is in trouble, right? In other news, oil was slumping to a 7-month low on the heels of the strength in the dollar. We're looking at approximately $70 to $71 on barrel of oil. We're still not quite seeing that at the pump, though, however. It looks like we're at about $2.70 to $3 down here in Florida. But hopefully soon enough, that'll be reassurance to us down here. Other news, Gordon Brown resigned as the Prime Minister of Britain, with David Cameron taking over his position. David Cameron will hope to establish a little bit of stability over in Britain. However, the VIX hit almost a year high at $40. The VIX is typically the fear index in the markets, and it looks like we're going to have some trouble here in the next couple weeks. The VIX is currently trading at around 32, and that could signal a little bit of fear still in the marketplace. Morgan Stanley appears to also be being dragged into the market with Goldman with regards to the mortgage-backed security issue that Goldman was facing, and the fact that they were betting against what they were actually selling to their investors. So this could be a continued issue amongst many of the other banks, including Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and it may leak into some of the other major banks such as J.P. Morgan and other large institutions. On the economic front, we saw retail sales come out on Friday. We saw decent numbers actually here. We saw a 0.4 print versus expectations of only 0.2, with also the prior being revised higher to 2.1 from 1.6. So it looks like we're still seeing some spending coming into the retail area. However, some of these consumer discretionary stocks have pulled back quite a bit recently. So we're hoping to see maybe on this a little strength come into the consumer discretionary stocks. X Autos, however, on the retail front, we saw 0.4 versus expectations of 0.5, but the prior was revised a little bit higher as well, 1.25 from 0.9. Continuing claims, or the number of new people claiming unemployment or state unemployment benefits, rose a little bit more than expectations this week at 444,000 claiming unemployment benefits. However, in the continuing claims saw a much larger print than what was expected. In other news, We saw the exchange rules for the circuit breakers to be published here pretty soon, as early as next week, Monday, May 17th. We could see some changes to the rules, as it was suspected that the NYSE had a little bit of a slowdown process when the trading becomes fast and the downside volatility begins to increase, whereas some of the other exchanges did not have those rules, and that's why we saw these stocks such as Accenture and whatnot go down to point or about once or one penny. So there will be some new rules that hopefully will keep this volatility to a minimum and allow investors to still feel safe and stable when entering the market. So these different exchanges, such as like Arca and Island and various others, will soon have to abide by these rules in order to keep some consistency throughout the many different exchanges.
All right, Kevin. Well, happy birthday to you, buddy boy, and thanks so much for that update in the news. That was great stuff. I mean, there's a lot of very, very conflicting information, as you can see from what Kevin was talking about. You know, we have these problems in Europe. We have these issues with the regulatory environment. And on top of that, we are seeing some good news on the economics front, not to mention the fact that a lot of earnings are actually coming in quite impressive. So really right now, we're thinking this at this moment of time right now as a pullback in a continuing uptrend. That's what it looks like right now. And if you think about it right now, that's really what all the charts are showing and really what all the economics are showing. The problem is, and the real sticky point here, the fly in the ointment, if you will, is Europe. That's the problem right now, and how quickly they can get their problem under control is really going to be as quickly as we can get back on track here. Anyway, so thanks a lot again, Kevin. And anybody that would like to find out more about the things that we talk about on a regular basis, just go over and check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It's our blog where we post all sorts of information, charts, and also analysis. We talked about Sprint this week before it took off, and that was a great buy point. We also talk about many of the different economics and just a whole host of things right on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. When we get back, we're going to bring on that interview with Tom McClellan, and I think you'll find it very interesting. It's a really great interview, and this is something that you want to pay attention to. He's a very smart guy and a guy that I look to for research and for information. So stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Okay, as I promised, we are back with Tom McClellan. And this is a special treat because I read his work, and I think he's one of the smartest guys that I know. Because that, I'll tell you how I know that, is because a lot of things he writes, I'm thinking, I got to read it like three times, saying, And not that it's difficult to read, but some of the concepts are really very intense, and he makes it, he does make it simple to understand, but there's a lot of things that go into the processes and the calculation that he does, and this is a man who specializes in mathematics and runs what's called the McClellan Market Report, plus the Daily Edition. We'll get into that. He's been a guest before. Tom, how are you?
I'm great. It's a sunny day in the Pacific Northwest, so it's a rare treat here.
Yeah, it is. That's true. But it's always sunny down here in Florida. We're pretty much at polar opposites in the United States, you and I, you know, from distance-wise. But fortunately for us, the magic of phones are always bringing us closer. So let's talk about it. So much to talk about. In your recent letter, you talked about, or at least a few of the recent letters you've written about, the topic that everybody seems to be talking about, which, by the way, that being the case scares the bejesus out of me, which is gold. And everybody wants to buy gold companies, silver companies, precious metals, everything but the obviously forever deflating currencies that are out there, the sovereign currencies. You've talked about this thing, this 13.5-month cycle, right?
Yes, that's an important cycle for gold prices.
So two things I want to start with, and I want you to just kind of give it all to me. First of all, cycles. How do I differentiate the whole concept of cycle from hocus pocus? Like, does that really happen? And then tell me why this particular cycle happens and what it's all about for gold.
Well, I don't have an explanation of why a cycle of a period of 13.5 months exists in gold. I cannot explain it to you. There's no natural human events that occur on that time frame, like the annual cycle or the political cycle, there's nothing human-related that we can explain it. So we can only conclude from a physics standpoint that it is what we would call a natural cycle or a natural frequency. Sort of like when you're driving down the road in kind of a bumpy freeway in your car, you might notice that at 50 miles an hour, it's really bumpy, but at 60 miles an hour, it's a little smoother. That's because the frequency of the up and down of your tires hits the natural frequency of the chassis of your car at 50 miles an hour, but it moves out at a different speed. So that's what you're doing, is you're seeing a natural frequency, a harmonic frequency of something, as opposed to if you're just sitting at idle and you rev your car up to 3,000 RPM, you'll feel that, but it's not because you're feeling the natural frequency. That's the excitation force at a certain speed. So, you know, if we were to see a 3-month cycle in stock prices, well, when we would conclude that's earnings related, because earnings are published mm-hmm. on a 3-month and a quarterly basis. Right. But we don't tend to see cycles arise on convenient schedules like that. The market's natural cycles have much stranger periods, and which makes it much tougher to analyze. But if you can successfully do it, it's much more profitable, because the harder it is to do, the fewer people can do it, and so therefore there's the opportunity for the guy who can solve it.
It's interesting that we have this cycle of any sort in the market, if you really consider it for a moment. But not that that isn't true, that there are not cycles, but it's kind of fascinating that there are cycles, because it almost, you know, collides with the fact that you know, that there are people doing things in mass that are according to a certain, you know, regular process. But I mean, like I said, you know, we do know the presidential cycles, but that has some meaning to it, right? I don't think
right. That's an external excitation force. Right. Every 4 years, we have a political process that we go through, and people respond to that either with hope or with fear. And there's predictable results on the stock market that you see repeated on a time after time on this 4-year cycle. Right now, we are in the second year of the current presidential term, which typically is when bad things happen. There was a horrible bear market in 1974, which eclipsed the previously worst bear market in 1970. These things tend to happen in the second year of a presidential term. 1982 was a big recession and bear market. 1990, helped along by Saddam Hussein, but also by the Fed choking off liquidity, that was a bad market that came in the second year of a presidential term. We're not seeing quite the same sort of setup in terms of illiquidity this time, because the Fed has been printing money like mad, and when you print more money, it has to go somewhere, so it's been going in the stock market. We're not seeing the same sorts of illiquidity that we've seen in past instances of the second year of a presidential term. But there's still going to be some of that effect that goes on this time, because usually a president who comes into office will try to get all the bad stuff out of the way in the first 2 years, get everything done that's hard to get done, so that he can spend the last 2 years telling you how great a job he did and why you should reelect him. That's what every president does, Democrat or Republican. Right. It's all the same script they follow. Right. And so we're seeing some of that going on now. And there's also the worry as we head into November about the midterm elections, mm-hmm. about what the outcome will be. The market can handle just about any outcome of those elections, no matter who wins.
Right.
But it's not knowing what the outcome will be that
kind
bothers the market.
People, yeah. Well, you know, the other thing is that obviously when it comes to this whole presidential cycle, you know, this one is a little bit different only because of the amount of stimulus that went into it. But at the same time, it's not different only because then you still believe that they tried to do everything they can the first session in. Although, It appears to me that no matter what happens in our situation in the U.S., and forget about, you know, outside of the U.S. right now, that, you know, when unemployment benefits will run out, they're going to renew again. When the, you know, who knows if we're going to have another cash for clunkers? Who knows what other stimulus is going to happen? It seems like there's this never-ending stream, which brings us, you know, all the way back to the whole idea of gold and precious metals. Now, is this somehow related? Is this 13.5-year cycle, does it have to do with recessionary periods as well at all? Have you ever looked at that?
Well, it's a 13.5-month cycle in gold.
Sorry, yeah.
The longer cycle is a 40-year cycle in gold. But most of the people who lived through the last peak in the 40-year cycle in gold aren't going to be around for this one, so they won't remember. Mm-hmm. The 13.5-month cycle, I really truthfully cannot explain why it works on gold. I just observe that it does, and it has a few quirks. We're in the first part of it since the last bottom to that cycle was in late December. And the actual low in gold prices was a little bit late this time, but we're still on the upswing of that cycle, and we've been on an upswing in gold prices. But from a larger fundamental standpoint, if you want to talk about it from a non-technical, non-cycle standpoint, the big fundamental force that's helping gold right now is that we have negative real yields on short-term interest rates. The inflation rate is 2 to 3%, if you believe the CPI numbers, which that's a whole separate topic, and the Fed is keeping short-term interest rates down at a quarter point or less.
Right.
So the real yield is minus 2%. If you put your money into something that earns interest on a short-term basis, you're losing 2% every year because inflation is eating up the value of that money. When you have that condition of negative real yields, it tends to be tremendously stimulative to gold. And the best example of that was the 1970s. The Fed just was unwilling to get a handle on inflation. They never got the short-term interest rates up above the inflation rate all through the 1970s, and gold screamed higher. Only when Volcker finally got some courage and jacked up interest rates to horrible levels did we finally get inflation under control, and gold peaked out at $900 for about a nanosecond and then fell all the way back down into the 200s again.
You know, one of the things I really like, this you know, as I mentioned, Tom writes the McClellan Market Report, and he has a free daily edition, I think it's called, on the website. There's a variety of other things, but one of the things that's really neat about what you do, and it's something that I find that takes a lot of patience, because a lot of different possible alternatives and of ways to look at this, but is your analogs. And what I mean by that, for those who don't understand what I'm talking about, is he looks at different things like, okay, what did a particular market do over a period of time, and how does that compare to today? If there is some kind of predictability, at least somewhat of predictability, involved in the long-term history repeating itself, so that you know you believe that there is some type of basic way to monitor this, you know, is there a way then to chart this and to look at this, you know, effectively? Now, one of the things that Tom did is on his recent one, was the May 4th McClellan Market Report, is he plotted the log scale of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, a total 40 years, and from 40 years ago, and then offset it, right? Is that giving the right definition?
Well, we made a comparison of the uptrending period that the market saw from the 1942 bottom, when we were in the throes of World War II. There was the great uptrend all through the 40s and the 50s. The market topped out and went sideways in the 60s. We saw a similar rise in the stock market from the 1982 bottom all throughout the 80s and 90s. The market topped out in 2000 and has been going largely sideways. So there's a similarity just in the pattern, but there's also an underlying similarity that the 40-year cycle that I referred to earlier exists in the stock market. It exists in gold prices. It also exists in other things like economic wars that tend to arise about every 40 years. In social phenomena like the whole 60s protest movement, we saw echoes of the 60s protest movement just recently in a variety of ways. It also existed in the 1920s, protesting against prohibition and against a variety of governmental things, and we saw a huge social protest movement in the 1880s. So the 40-year cycle is something that recurs in a variety of human social phenomena like the movements of stock prices. It also shows up in the birth rate.
Right. And then this is happening, actually, the social unrest part of it that you mentioned is happening to a significant degree in, we'll just say, in parts of Europe right now, which I have actually, you know, about a year ago, when I looked at this from a very objective standpoint, I looked at all the things that were going on in not only in Europe but around the world, and it appeared to me that there was going to be a significant amount of social unrest that would be developing due to the higher taxes, pullbacks on spending, and the overall governmental intervention, you know, at first good, but then starting to, you know, kind of get a little bit over to the top. As a matter of fact, last week we saw that there was an announcement that the government is going to try to expand government hiring, and in doing so, they are going to create some type of system that will stream and slipstream the hiring process and make it much easier to become a government employee. So woohoo for that. We're all thrilled about growing government, I'm sure. But so let's talk about it. So we talked about gold. So gold now, give me where your projection is, because you do a good job of this. You predict where is gold going to peak time-wise, and what's your projection that you're looking at right now?
Well, for the short term, I'm saying gold is peaking now. We saw gold starting to head higher on a flight to quality trade, which interestingly caused gold prices to decouple from their normal inverse relationship to the dollar. As bad things were happening in Greece and throughout the other European countries that are at risk right now, money started flowing into the dollar, but it also started flowing into gold. If you look at a price chart of gold prices measured in euros, it's an unbelievable run-up.
Yeah.
Huge blow-off. People started pushing money into gold because of that flight to quality fear, but it's become a self-fulfilling thing now where the price of gold is going up because people are buying it, and that's causing people to buy it because it's going up. It's a little bit of circular logic, but the market doesn't care if your logic is circular as long as it works for a while. Eventually, though, people run out of money to invest in gold, and the blow-off will exhaust itself. And as I'm watching it now, the price of gold appears to be heading downward. And usually when you have a blow-off top like that and over the period of days or even a couple of weeks in gold prices, what's notable about them is that the slope downward out of the blow-off top is symmetrical to the slope upward. So we're looking for an ugly sell-off in gold that will erase all or nearly all of the blow-off gains, but set gold up for the next uptrend that it can do a few weeks from now.
Now, you also...
So I wouldn't be all that excited about gold right now just because we've had a blow-off. Right. Wait a couple of days and you can buy it wholesale instead of paying full retail price.
So one of the things, and by the way, there is something, I've been tracking some of the gold issues when it comes to whether or not there really is all this gold that's available or it's being kind of paper traded. And what I mean by that is oftentimes when people buy gold through an ETF and through other means, the idea is that there is a backing. The actual bullion is backing the buy. The question is that really the case, or is a lot of paper being issued right now saying it's gold? Aside from that, the point, though, is with that, when we look at the gold market and we look at the amount of gold that's available, we're going to see if that's going to really play a big role. If there's a further devaluations in currencies, the yuan is revalued on the upside. There's a lot of little things that are going on within the world of gold, but let's kind of leave that for another day. Let's talk about your oscillators. One of the big things that you're known for is the McClellan oscillator and the summation index and a variety of other those nifty things that you put together. One of the things that you really focus in on these is the advanced decline indicators, right? Various, New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ. Explain to me why the advanced decline index is such an important way to look at things rather than just price.
Well, the McClellan oscillator and the summation index were developed by my parents back in the late 1960s. They wanted to have a way of looking at the stock market using something else other than just the major averages. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was really the one that everybody watched back then. The S&P 500 wasn't really caught on as a popular average back then. But you can look at what prices are doing, but if you can look at something else that describes what prices are doing that's tied to a different thing, you can get additional, deeper information. What they found and what we've continued to find over the years is that advanced decline statistics for the NYSE are tremendously valuable as what I call a liquidimeter. It tells you more than anything else about the health of the liquidity stream. The reason for that is that if you're going to get a majority of stocks to go up, which will cause the advanced decline statistic to show more advances than declines and to move the cumulative AD line upward, it takes a large amount of money to do that. So if you see the advanced decline line moving upward, if you see more advances and declines on a persistent basis, that tells you that there's a lot of money out there by definition. Now, you can get them all to go up for one day or all to go down for one day. So one day isn't worth very much as a piece of data. You want to see a trend over several days or weeks. And when there is plenty of money like that, when liquidity is very plentiful, it's a condition that tends to persist for a long time. It doesn't turn on a dime. It doesn't end instantaneously. Right now, all that money is available because, A, the Fed is creating it, and B, a bunch of it is coming back off the sidelines where it went to hide during the ugliness of 2008. So we're seeing money coming out of money market accounts, coming out of cash, coming out of wherever, and going into the stock market because people finally feel that it's safe. And that's getting added to all the money that the Fed is pumping into the banking system by creating additional money and growing M1 and M2. So it's a wonderful, it's like Miracle-Gro on compost. It's just a lot of fertilizer to push the stock market up.
So let me say this another way, and let me try to simplify this for a point. You say when there's a lot of liquidity, you see that the markets are being or stocks are being pushed up, the advanced decline line will rise, and that will last for some time. Can't happen over one day. You need to see a trend. But one of the things I think you're mentioning here is if the advanced decline line is moving up, it's really the obviously the advancing stocks versus the declining stocks. And the only way that happens is if there is extra money in the market, because if you have an even advanced decline line, theoretically, it could be that one money's coming out of one stock and into another. Therefore,
right.
It's a churn.
And I would clarify what you just said a little bit. A lot of money available to the market. And here's a trivia question you can ask your friends in the bar. Ask them, how much money is in the stock market? And see what they have to say. And it's a trick question, because there is no money in the stock market at all. The minute you put $100 into the stock market, it immediately comes out the other side. No money stays in the stock market at all. So when you say that you have your money in the stock market, that's actually not true. Your money is not there. The only way you can get money back out of the stock market is that if you can convince somebody to give you his money in exchange for your stock. And last week we saw, during the flash crash, we saw the unwillingness of people to part company with their money at any price.
Right.
But that's an important thing for people to remember. There is no money in the stock market. Money can come into and out of the market when it's available to the stock market from the banking system or from wherever, but there is no money there. And people should get over the idea that they have got their money in the stock market, because they don't.
Well, to talk about last week, I think that's really important, because how does that now play into, I mean, this is kind of a really interesting scenario here, because if you're looking, you know, just from a technician standpoint, when you're looking at, if you looked at charts only, you would see almost every chart is just busted. The patterns are messed up. If you look at things like an average true range calculation, where you find that you look at various ranges, I mean, it's busted because of that one day's range, 2 days ranges. I mean, and that may be something that's important to look at, and that may be something that actually does work. But it seems to me that we almost need a do-over, that whole bottom part of that candle that flew down to the floor on some of these stocks need to be almost reset. I mean, how do you actually look at this?
That's a great point. A lot of issues, especially a lot of ETFs, went all the way down to zero or down to a penny because all the bids were pulled, and there were sells that had to get traded at any price, and so you had ridiculous pricing. And Louise Yamada has a great line about what to do about that. She says, just put your thumb over that part of the chart.
That's what we've been doing.
Because
put a piece of paper
over it. Not a reflection. That's not a reflection of what the market was, or what the market said, because there was no market at that point. The regulators or the authorities decided that the market could not exist for 15 minutes, and that created all sorts of problems with people who thought that there still was a market. And so if you're trying to have a reflection of the market, and somebody causes the market to cease to exist, it's going to skew the charts and skew all sorts of things. We used to joke around that the difference between technical analysis and chart analysis is that unlike earnings, the chart will never be revised later. Well, we've seen a change to that rule this
time. That's right. No, they were revised. So, it's a good point, but I agree.
And you're left with, you know, what do I do about that? And it's a tough question without a single great answer.
You know, it's because one thing that you could do is you can put a piece of paper over, you can ignore it, you know, just take that one part out of the downward part. It's also, you know, make sure to use a closing price for some of your calculations rather than the intraday price for the calculations for the low. But again, that does cause some problems for a variety of oscillators. It will you know, the short-term oscillators, that will be gone soon enough in a few weeks, obviously. But
you're absolutely right that it causes problems from an analytical standpoint, but there's going to be larger problems that are going to be caused from a market function standpoint. And I think that's a topic worth exploring. We live in this era of the instant replay, where a play in football or a basketball can be gone back and reviewed and reversed, because we can view it from reverse angles and all sorts of ways and decide that, no, it didn't really happen the way that it was originally called. And that idea has permeated lots of society, and it's crept into the market. We've now got the SEC going back and reviewing all the trades that ever took place on the 6th of May, and they have decided that they are empowered to cancel some of those trades. So you had a case where you had a willing buyer and a willing seller who agreed to trade a security at a certain price, and the authorities are coming along and they're deciding later, no, we're going to cancel that. We're going to cancel that agreement. We're going to cancel that trade, and it doesn't exist. And what that does is that says to the guy who's got cash sitting on the sidelines waiting to look for a bargain that you should be fearful that if a bargain is too good, it might get taken away from you, and you might not get what you thought you got. And what that's going to do is it's going to cause money to not be around to swoop in and buy bargains. It's going to cause liquidity to disappear from the market because the liquidity didn't get treated well.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It's going to be a huge negative for the stock market to have the authorities decide who they're going to allow to get a good deal and who they're going to take that good deal away from.
On the other hand, that's a terrible destructive force. On the other hand, it does give those that have the high risk the ability to say, you know what? What bad can happen to me because, you know what, I'm protected by the government. Look at what happened with the Chrysler bonds. To some extent, from a company standpoint, how they came in and changed the rules, and everybody's all excited about that. Look at more importantly, recently, the government said, and the administration, particularly President Obama, announced that they're looking to rewrite retroactively the amount of money that BP may be liable for in this spill. The same thing happened recently with solar companies in Spain. They said, you know what, they're retroactively going to take back some of their special treatment.
Special sanctions. Yeah, it's a horrible development because it's gonna cause people to change their behavior in terms of accepting risk because they can accept more risk knowing that Uncle Sam might bail them out, and it's gonna chase money away that might be willing to take a risk in exchange for the possibility of a huge return because Uncle Sam might decide it's too big of a return for you to get there.
Right.
It's a really bad situation, and I hope that the regulators will soon see the error of their ways.
Good luck, my friend. We both know that's not going to happen, right?
Well,
we hope. We can hope.
Eventually, they'll learn eventually
after a few mistakes. Okay, so let's talk about volume now. Volume has been a real issue. It's been a thorn in the side of most professionals. It's been a question that a lot of people look at. You have a variety of oscillators that look at volume also. Lowry's is always one of the names that comes up when it comes to this whole volume issue and, 90% days and down days and all that. Yeah. Now, here's the question I want to ask you. It is consistent that we are seeing massive, monumental volume on days that the markets are down, signifying that money is being selling action, right? But at the same time, we're not seeing that same volume when the markets move up. In other words, there's not a strong appetite for buying. But meanwhile, there's not obviously, you can't say on the days that things are moving up that there's an appetite for selling either. You follow what I'm saying? Because it wouldn't work that way. And the slow creep up on small volume or lighter volume than you would say either on average or on the days where you see significant moves down, are contrary to what the quote-unquote old books and old-fashioned would tell you that you want to see.
You're hitting on a great point. We used to know what volume was because it had a clear definition. Volume was trade that took place at the exchange. Now that the majority of trading in NYSE-listed stocks, now that it's gotten done off of the floor of the NYSE, and some of that involves trading back and forth at high frequencies between just a pair of traders sometimes, you don't really know that that's the same indication of trading volume that you used to think of. So my response is to trust volume numbers less now than I used to, and to not weight them as much in my decision making as I used to. I just don't believe that they are indicating the same things that they used to, and so I don't place as much analytical emphasis on what the volume numbers say just because I don't believe that they're reflecting the truth. So I can't rely on their indications as much as I used.
Although I will say that I think that the volume indications on an individual security can be more reliable than on a broad-based market.
Well, my focus is more on the overall market, so I haven't studied that as much as I would need to give a good answer.
Okay.
To that.
Well, get back to me when you get a chance on that. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So listen, I want to talk about the bull trend. It looks to me that you had a signal in place for a while that talks about that the bottoming of a variety of your indicators, and you're getting a cluster. You talk about clusters that you're showing a bottoming somewhere in the neighborhood of mid-May, we'll call it. That a lot of them are coming all at once. They're signaling the same thing all at once. Explain to me your clusters.
That's a great question. And what you're referring to is signals that we list in our newsletter. We call them timing models just because we're not very good at thinking up jazzy names for them. And it's a mathematical technique that I developed many years ago before I ever started writing the newsletter that uses the various indicators that we use to predict future turning points of the stock prices. The existence of a signal arises out of a single indicator on either breadth or price or volume, and it tells you that there is either a top or a bottom due at some specific date in the future. The signal itself won't tell you the context of that top or bottom. I like to say that sometimes a top is what the stock market, what prices go up into, and sometimes a top is what prices go down out of. it doesn't necessarily have to be shaped like an inverted V. And so it's up to us, using our analytical powers, to look at everything else that's happened and try to figure out what the context of that signal is. When you see multiple signals arriving in a short time frame, the inference is that they're all referring to the same event, even though they may not all be coming on the same day. The accuracy of these things is not perfect when you're. It's like making a rifle shot from 300 yards. The two successive rifle shots may both hit the target, but they're not necessarily going to go through the same mm-hmm. hole. And so, if you have a bottom signal for the 23rd and the bottom actually comes on the 24th, and you made that prediction a month ago, that's still pretty accurate and still pretty useful. We have a big cluster of bottom signals due May 11th to 14th, which is the time window right now when we're doing the interview, and the market still seems to be topping. I had the expectation that we're going to see some sort of swoon into this time period. What may have happened is that the asteroid that landed in the ocean last week with the flash crash may have disrupted the normal flow of liquidity into and out of the market, and so it's like you may have a surf forecast for waves 3 to 5 feet that you can surf, but when the asteroid comes, it can blow away your surf forecast.
So that bottom that could have happened, and then what was your projection following that?
Well, we're still looking for the market to head upward into June. Prior to the flash crash, I had the expectation that the major averages might make marginally higher highs, not huge uptrend to substantial new highs above the levels we saw in April, but marginally higher. By virtue of how far the market got pulled down, that does not look as likely. But we're still looking for a top of some kind. We don't know exactly what kind, but a top of some kind, June 4th to 8th. And then we can get into some more ugly corrective work between June and, say, October, as we have the normal weak seasonality of the summer and the fall, and as we start to worry about the upcoming midterm election, and as liquidity starts to dry up with the Fed finally deciding that it can start doing its job of fighting inflation.
Yeah, because right now, the last several, we'll call them corrections, for lack of a better word, have been almost momentary. You know, you get this really, you know, you get a little bit of a lag and a little bit of slowing down and maybe a percent here, and then wham, it flows down, and then, you know, it just kind of moves, and then all of a sudden, wham, it just moves right back up into the next trend. So
this, all during March and April, it was one day. It was all you could
right.
get.
And so now this would be called, I guess the best way we describe it is it's a pullback in a bull trend right now. I guess that's the best way to describe it. Would you agree?
I would agree. We still have a pattern of higher lows and higher highs, which is the definition of an uptrend.
Right.
But the slope of that uptrend is starting to level off. And in physics terms, if you have an upward trend that starts going sideways, a physicist would say that is a negative acceleration. You are accelerating downward to change the upward trend to sideways.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
Like the rocket that suddenly runs out of fuel, even though it hasn't started heading back down to crash in the ocean, it's no longer accelerating upward, and it's peaking out in its
arc.
That's
a great way to look at things.
And that's why the McClellan Oscillator and Summation Index are so valuable, is because they look at the acceleration that is taking place in the advanced decline statistics, which is the liquidimeter I talked about before, and they can tell you, they can detect when the acceleration is changing even before that starts to show up as a downward movement in stock prices. Mm.
Well, the daily report, one of the things that I really liked on May 4th, I liked market acting stronger than it's supposed to. You know, one of the things I like, Tom, seriously, is that you tell it as it is with oftentimes just, you know, very much factual. Although, have I noticed a little bit of more first-person narratives in some of this lately?
Well, I am the first person who's writing it. hopefully, there aren't second and third people who are also writing it. But you know, everybody talks who looks at the market talks about it as in terms of the view from their own foxhole. I don't know if that's really what you're asking, but
I see it as
the view from my foxhole. When I talk about what I am expecting and what I am observing, and people should interpret that not in terms of a guarantee of what's going to happen, but in terms of reviewing Tom McClellan's opinion compared to their own opinion and compared to what they're seeing.
No, I guess that I was just noticing some of the ones that I was reading recently just had a little bit more of a, I don't want to say personal, but it seemed like it was more personal, I guess, so, you know, versus just a report. I liked it. There's nothing negative about it. I thought it was great.
Well, good. Thank you for the compliment.
So right now, your model right now, you have a couple different ones, the Stock Optimizer, you have a few different ones, but right now you are generally short. Is that correct?
for our managed accounts clients, we're 50% short, expecting a pullback from this dead cat bounce that we saw following the flash crash. When you start talking about the physics of stock market movement, there is a similarity that can be seen when you have these very short-term panic events, like the like 1997, October 27th, 1997, when the circuit breakers got hit and the Dow was down 554 points. There's a lot of similarity between the market action then and now. You have a bounce up for just a day or two, and then you pause, and you go back and you attempt to retest the low one or more times. And I'm expecting that that's what's in the cards right now. And when I see that pullback attempt that attempts to retest the low and gets everybody thinking that, oh, the sky actually is falling, well, then we can buy into that dip and ride the next bounce upward.
And what's the time frame on that? Weeks?
We're talking week. Looking for the bottom of that pullback sometime this week, which we're running out of. Today's a Thursday the 13th, and so there's not much more time left for it. And then we start back upward into June, partly because in response to the flash crash, there's been a lot of money that's been thrown at the stock market to try to rescue it and push it back upward, both by the Fed and by the banks that were involved. So that money's going to start getting digested as the market rallies. But along about June, I would not expect great things to happen again for several more months. It'll be great environment for traders who've got their track shoes on, can nimbly jump in and out, but it's not going to be a great time for investors between June and October.
So, but if you don't, Tom, if you don't get this this corrective mode or testing the bottom sometime, you know, in the next few days, do you take your and turn it back on to a bullish move, or you wait till you actually get that correction?
That depends on how it unfolds. Right. You have an expectation of what's supposed to happen, and ideally the market will fulfill your expectation, but you always have to watch because sometimes things can happen differently, and it would depend on in what manner it turns out different. That's why traders and technicians use stops and constantly look at what's happening. They don't chisel their trading schedule in stone on the calendar. They watch what actually happens and have to respond to what develops.
I hear you. Well, Tom McClellan's information and his daily review can be found on his website at www.mcoscillator.com. And you can actually email him at tom@mcoscillator.com if you want to get his McClellan market report. It's only a couple of hundred bucks a year. I got to tell you something. This is absolutely something that you can read on a regular basis to really get an understanding of the pulse of the market, the trends, and the information. I find to be just invaluable. So this is information that I'd like you to check out. We'll put, of course, notes and information on the show notes of this particular episode. But again, it's mcoscillator.com, like the McClellan Oscillator. And I really do encourage you to check it out. If nothing else, take a look at the daily report, which I think is free on the website.
No, the daily edition
is not free. Sorry.
But it's worth a lot, and people can sign up for that on the website. We do have a free service that people can sign up for. We call it our weekly chart and focus article, and you can get that emailed to you. You just have to sign up with your name and email. No strings attached. We won't bombard you with any marketing. We won't give your name to any other services. We're just trying to help people understand the sorts of analysis that we do, and hopefully they'll like it and decide that they want to take the subscription products. But there's no risk, no strings, nothing else. It's our chart and focus, and you can see that on our homepage and sign up for it.
Sorry about that, folks. I mean, I was giving away the farm, almost bankrupted Mr. McClellan here. just a totally off topic here for a second. We were talking about this weekend. Do you remember the old days when, well, first of all, let's set this up. The new days, the way you get music is you go to iTunes, you get an MP3 file from somewhere, whatever it is, you download it, you listen to it, it was great. You get an album, maybe buy a CD, who knows how you... The old days, we used to get the Columbia Record Club. You remember that?
I've been 39 now for several years, so yes, I'm old enough to remember
and
that.
And you're probably still getting mail threatening that you have to pay the bill on the album that you never received. I don't know about you, but when you sign up for this, you get like 20 different CDs or albums, whatever it was, right? And then you got all this mail every single month, and you had to like paste this thing on of the special, but you had to always have a negative response if you did not want to receive the top hit of the month. And if you didn't do so, you'd get one in the mail. Remember that?
I remember those
and
days.
You always would be like, I didn't get that. Wait, I didn't order this. And so you have to call them up and argue, and then you did, and then go back and forth. And you had to do this for like 2 years. You were responsible to buy like 8 albums in 2 years for the 20.
Yeah, it was a horrible way to treat customers.
Terrible. And it was like, oh, I can't take it anymore. So you'd always have this thing when I was young, this outstanding
like seeing on my credit report for the Columbia Record Company. I didn't pay it. And I was like, you know, when you're first applying for your credit card in life, you're like, and they're like, oh, Columbia Record Club, we get it. We understand. Anyway.
Well, we've endeavored not to treat our customers that way. We have a money-back guarantee. Anybody wants to cancel at any time, we'll refund the balance. So it's as risk-free as it can be, just because that's the way we'd like to be treated. And so we try to treat everybody.
Yeah, you're one of the good guys. I appreciate it. I appreciate your writing and your perseverance in these areas and for joining us today. Thanks a lot. Tom McClellan, great guest. Well, thanks very much for joining me. Thanks to Tom McClellan. I encourage you to go check out what he has and has to offer. And, of course, if you want to find out more about how we manage money, it's maybe time for you to consider, hey, maybe I should jump back in. Maybe I should get a little hedging. Maybe I should do a little bit something more than I'm doing right now. That's what we're here for. Check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com for a 14-minute video, a virtual tour of our strategy. And we'll see you next week. We have, who do we have coming on next week? You know, I always forget to put this down, but I know there was somebody good. Who was it now? I know we were talking about, oh boy, I shouldn't have even brought it up and put that out there. I got to bring that back. I'll tell you about it in an upcoming blog post. Watch your Twitter account. If you're tracking me at Andrew Horowitz or on Facebook, we'll make sure to have an upcoming feature of who's coming on next week. And it should be a lot of fun. I know we have Damon, if you remember him, from Briefing.com coming over. Hopefully Charles Kirk from the Kirk Report. We've talked to him a couple times recently, and it looks like that we have him lined up coming on soon. Hopefully we'll cross our fingers. Of course, we'll have Frank Curzio on, and if you haven't heard me, I was on his show last week. So lots to talk about, and don't forget about the few stocks I talked about. Look into them, research them, Concho Resources, CXO, and St. Mary's, which you'll find in oil development in the oil area. Just check those out, look at it, and of course, Lululemon, talked about a few of those. And if you want to find out some of the stocks that we're looking at on DH Unplugged, there is a link on DH Unplugged to look at all the spreadsheet stocks that we've talked about over the last several weeks. We'll speak to you soon. Thanks for joining me again. This is Andrew Horowitz saying bye-bye for now.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.